And and the really fascinating thing, which was so beautiful, was just, you know, when I would go through impoverished neighborhoods, witnessing that those who faced the most adversity, they were the ones who had the most to give. And it wasn't only about giving money, it was about giving attention and being seen by them.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with Daniel Troia, whose film We Are All in This Together is a documentary about bicycling across America with no food and no money in search of human connection. In an election year when so much news centers on discord and division, Daniel's project is a nice reminder of the kindness one can find in America. Over the course of our conversation, Daniel and I talk about everything from how travel can be a way to work through grief, to the way making yourself vulnerable brings out the confessional side of people, to the strange discoveries one makes when dumpster diving in America. Again and again, Daniel found that the people most likely to help him with food or money were people who didn't have much themselves and who knew what it felt like to be on the receiving end of kindness. The project was, in fact, about the importance of kindness and centering kindness and showing up for people in a way that makes them feel seen and appreciated. Daniel is a do-it-yourself filmmaker, and this was his first feature documentary, so we also talked about the task of making a travel documentary using camera glasses and a drone and a GoPro. Our conversation starts with the description of the project and how his travel experiment was admittedly different from people who are forced into the same situation by life circumstances. Let's listen in.
And so, Daniel, you took a bike trip across the United States, but it just wasn't any bike trip. Yours had special constraints. And so what were the constraints of your bike trip and why did you decide to do it?
Yeah, so I left my home in California with no food, no money, and a sign that said, biking across country, ran out of food, anything helps. And I decided to make a documentary about it. And the reason why I wanted to make a documentary about my journey across America with no food or money is because I started to really feel the tension in the country the last couple of years, the political division. And coincidentally, somebody gifted me a book. It was called The Kindness of Strangers, and it was about a guy who hitchhiked across America in the 1990s with no food or money. And he was just gathering all these stories from people who helped him. And I thought, man, I would love to do something similar, but I'd love to do it on a bike. And so that's kind of what inspired the trip is that.
Had you done something like this before, like long-term bike rides, or had you traveled much of the U.S. before? What was your travel background?
Yeah, I had biked across America one time a couple of years earlier. It was funny. I went from Portland, Oregon to New York City. And the day that I left on that trip, I was 28 and I had never even camped before. Like, so I remember leaving Portland, Oregon, just thinking like, I have no idea what I'm doing right now. But that's what was so beautiful about it. And what's so beautiful about travel is because you really step out of your comfort zone and then you learn so much about yourself and you challenge yourself and you're so stimulated doing that, you know, obviously, you know, with your travel experiences.
Yeah. And I love the idea of just planning something and then figuring it out as you go. Like, I don't know, I've never camped before, but I guess I'm going to have to learn now. So was there an aspect of that to this most recent trip?
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, I did read a book about dumpster diving before I left. So I knew that that was going to be an option. And but I had no idea there'd be so much food that was being thrown away from in the back of grocery stores. Right. And I also knew that my sign was unique. It said biking across country. So there was going to be I knew there was going to be a certain percentage of people who were just interested in that alone. So, and the unfortunate truth is I think I received more help than people who are actually struggling and living on the streets because my situation was more unique and interesting to other people.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of an exercise in empathy, but when you sort of do that experimental exercise in empathy, you're sort of separated from the people who have to do it by necessity, right?
Exactly.
So what other things did you have in your advantage as you launched out on this journey that a person who was forced to do it wouldn't have?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, I think just my skin color alone, like that right there was a huge part of it. And the reason I say that is because I met people on the road. For example, there was a black man who was biking from New York to California. And he asked me where I was staying every night. And I was like, honestly, man, most of the time I'm just staying in baseball fields. And he was like, cops don't bother you? And I said, you know, normally they just kind of tell me to leave early in the morning. And then he looked at me and he was like, Man, last week I was staying in a campground where I was supposed to be staying, and somebody called the cops on me. So I always just like to acknowledge that was definitely a privilege that I had, you know?
I think that comes out of any type of in-depth experience of this. Because when I traveled the U.S. by van in 94, you know, I was living in a van. I was showering in university facilities and jumping into motel pools where I wasn't staying. Yeah. And I met this guy in Memphis, really cool guy, you know, the kind of guy I would hang out with at home. And he was a busker and we were talking and he was asking me where I was staying. And I said, oh yeah, you know, you could totally walk into motels. You don't know that. And he's like, look at me, I'm black. I can't, you know, I get in trouble when you do that. And I think that's always a good thing to acknowledge is that there's some things in a country like the United States, which is our own country. There's some things that we have in our, just by being born the way we are that other people don't, right? There's certain generalizations. And actually at the risk of jumping ahead, you were treated differently when your beard grew long, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question. So when I looked like this, there was a couple of things that go into that. But when I looked like this,
You mean with a fairly trimmed beard and short hair?
Exactly. Fairly trimmed beard. Yeah, exactly. And I was on the road for 7 months. Right. And so by the time, you know, the 7 month came around, I was longer hair up here and like really like bushy beard. And not only that, but the lifestyle that I was living was super stressful after 7 months. So I was the stealth camping. I mean, there was a couple of times where I got in this really dangerous situations that was honestly traumatizing, like people coming up to my tent at 3 a.m. And then just like the stress of trying to find enough food to eat for the day and trying to find a place to bathe, et cetera. So I was putting out different energy. And based on the way I was looking and the energy, it was pushing people away. So I wasn't receiving nearly as much help as I did when I looked more clean cut and I felt stronger mentally and physically.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I had long hair before I took my van trip in 94 and I cut it off beforehand just because I knew that there are certain stereotypes that apply to a person who has longer hair or longer facial hair or ratty clothes or whatever. So I think there's all sorts of ways that you can play your hand a little bit better. And maybe did the presence of the bike make it easier for you? You think that thought, oh, here's a bicycler as opposed to here's a homeless man.
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, people saw that I was like on the go. So they looked at me as more of a traveler and then just somebody who was like staying in their town, if that makes sense. So the bicycle definitely helped. Yeah.
Well, I want to get back to dumpster diving because that was one of the more fascinating visual parts of your documentary, just all this actually delicious looking food that you literally found in the garbage. Yeah, but I want to just set up things first. Like, did you allow yourself to use a smartphone or internet or contact people ahead or anything like that?
Great question. Yeah. So I did have a smartphone as far as GPS and things like that. I purposely didn't reach out to any of my friends along the way because I kind of felt like that was cheating. And the whole thing was the whole part of the main reason I did this because I wanted to learn more about the human connection as far as between strangers, et cetera. I did stay with one friend when I got to New York City, though, because I thought I was going to stop in New York City, but I ended up continuing my journey for another 3.5 months. But yeah, so I used the GPS for that. But I didn't rely on anything else as far as that, like have a safety net other than that. Kind of interesting, Rolf. Like it was a time in my life where I think we all go through this where our parents will pass away eventually, you know, and my parents passed away. And then it created this sense of like recklessness in me, but in like a really positive way to where I felt like I want to go do some kind of travel experience. And I want to really push myself and learn about myself because you never know how long you're going to be around for, right? And so it was a blessing to have kind of a silver lining when you do go through some grief. It makes you look at life a lot more differently. And I thought the first thing I thought of was like, I need to do some kind of travel experience to kind of, you know, use my body and my life while I can, because who knows how long we'll be here for.
Yeah, I think that's baked into so many classic narratives, like all the way back to Gilgamesh, you know, Enkidu, Gilgamesh's friend died. But then like Wild, Cheryl Strayed's Wild and Martin Sheen's The Way, the fictional movie, that I think that there's something sort of existential and ritualistic about walking that it almost feels like necessary. Not that I want to be prescriptive that everybody should walk or take a bike or something as they're going through grief. But talk some more about that.
That's such a great point. And by the way, the movie, The Way, I love that movie. It's such a great movie. But yeah, I think that when you go through trauma or grief or sadness like that, sometimes the only thing that makes sense is do something very simple, like walking. I mean, when I was in Oregon, I met this man who was 65 years old. He'd walked from the Canadian border, and his goal was to reach in Big Sur, California, right? And so he was about, I think, like 800 miles away. And I asked him, I was like, hey, man, I'm just kind of curious, why are you doing this? And he said, you know, he said, a couple months ago, my doctor told me that I have terminal cancer and I'm going to die. Mm. And he said, the only thing that made sense to me was to walk. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think walking is a way to come back into ourselves. And I keep love defaulting it to walking because I'm more of a walker than a biker. And before we get into the details of the trip itself, how did the physical aspect of the trip change your experience, the experiences you were going to? Because like you started in the Mountain West, there's some pretty intense physical things going on there.
Yeah, I love the question, Rolf, man. So when you're on a bike or walking, you really take in your surroundings, right? And so, because you're going at a slower pace, so you're looking around, you're noticing things that you wouldn't normally notice when you're in a car. A big part of it is you smell the areas you're going through, and then you connect with the land. So like when you're going over the Colorado Rockies, for example, you really get to know the Rockies because you got to physically use your body, and you're breathing hard, you're breathing in the air, your legs are burning, you're taking in your surroundings. So it's just such a great way to really like truly know the landscape that you're riding through.
Would this count as a pilgrimage? Like when you're talking, I was thinking that, you know, the rite of pilgrimage, which is hundreds of years old, probably thousands of years old, involves that physical sacrifice, earning your way to your destination. Did that occur to you, or is it something you thought about?
You know, I haven't really thought about it, but what comes to mind when I think of a pilgrimage, I think of a little more like calm and peaceful, but because like as time went on, this lifestyle, just because things got kind of dangerous with the stealth camping, you know, sleeping in like different areas, I wouldn't say that I felt like at peace during it, especially as the lifestyle got more challenging. And the fact that I was like always having to be out in public, that started to kind of weigh on me. I didn't have, like on the west part of the country for sure, like, you know, there was beautiful stretches and were a lot more nature. But as I got farther east, things got a lot more compact. And I was going through like bigger cities and just, it just didn't really feel like as much of a pilgrimage, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, you can notice that in the film itself, but just the landscapes and the experiences change as you go from wide open spaces to more pinched and populated places, yeah, as you go east. But you said that the mission in a certain sense was to reestablish a sense for human connections. So how did your constraints, bicycle, no money, no food, how did that transform your social relationships and what kind of people did you meet?
Yeah, so definitely it put me out there, first of all, right? I think part of the reason why we have so much division in our country right now is people aren't talking face to face, right? And by putting myself in this, again, privileged but vulnerable position that I was in, it was forcing me to interact with people in communities that I normally wouldn't go through, for example, right? And so it was really fascinating to, first of all, meet people who had different opinions. Right. Because I'm in California, I'm in my own little bubble. But then when I was in West Virginia, I'm definitely meeting people with different opinions on things. And and the really fascinating thing, which was so beautiful, was just, you know, when I would go through impoverished neighborhoods and I just noticed that witnessing that those who faced the most adversity, they were the ones who had the most to give. And it wasn't only about giving money, it was about giving attention and being seen by them. Like I felt like they were the ones who were the most concerned about my well-being. And when I would ask everybody, if I was fortunate to receive help, I'd say, do you have a story about when somebody helped you and you really needed it? And what was pretty fascinating was when I went through the wealthier neighborhoods, they didn't have as many stories, right? But when I went through the impoverished neighborhoods, they just started naming off a bunch of stories about times that they'd been helped in their lives, which was fascinating.
Was there any, did you find that did people sort of have a religious faith underpinning it, or was it more about personal experience? What do you think motivated people to come and give you assistance?
Yeah, it was for sure mostly a personal experience, I'd say, because you could really feel it. Like there were times where you could just feel the energy of these people who really care. And there was times countless times where I almost felt taken back in a way of thinking like, this is a really beautiful moment I'm sharing with this complete stranger. And it totally changed my perspective on humanity, because in some ways it showed like that every day, like we have this super special opportunity to show up for someone. Mm. Right. And I was fortunate, but to be able to witness that for 7 months, people who saw somebody in a vulnerable position and showed up into my life.
Yeah. And maybe it was just the way it was edited, but I didn't see a lot of BMWs and Mercedes stopping and handing you food or money or whatever. So, And actually, I had my own experience. Once I sort of borrowed a Chevy Celebrity, not a very nice car. I was driving across America. I was in New Mexico. It broke down. And it wasn't the people who offered help were the people who could sort of relate. Maybe their car didn't work very well. Yes. And they just saw a guy who needed help. It was really interesting. Yes. So let's dig into this idea. In an age where we sort of relate to each other through screens, and the weird things about screens is the algorithm sort of throws us in the same spaces of people who already look and believe like
yes.
us.
Yes.
So what is it? Talk some more about this vulnerability and sort of the people who responded to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, just being out there, because like you said, we're in our own little bubbles. Right. And what I found fascinating was the people who responded, it revealed my own judgments. Hmm. Right. And for specifically is I found that I judge people who are more of the stereotypical, like macho guys. Like I would think in my mind when I'm standing out there with a sign that, oh, this guy is not going to help me because it's one of those more macho guys. And in my mind, maybe I'm thinking that they don't feel concerned for people or something like that. And it was really revealing and good to see about my own judgments about them, you know? And the other thing too is I realized that if I don't jump straight to politics right away when meeting someone, I give them more of an opportunity to relate to them on so many other issues. And then you can kind of ease into the political stuff and it's not nearly as like harsh and judgmental. Right. And that's, again, that's what this taught me is speaking face to face like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I live in Kansas, which nobody ever comes to Kansas. You know, they come to Kansas on the way to somebody else. And oftentimes my well-meaning friends from the coasts, they'll start by asking people like political questions, like instead of, like, what do your kids do for fun around here or whatever? They go straight into these political stereotypes that they attach to a certain place. It sounds like maybe you attach certain stereotypes to certain brawny macho men. And so did you ever come into a situation where it was really complicated? Like somebody gave you hospitality, but they were a little bit creepy or racist or anything like that?
I'm so glad you asked that question because this was so important that I experienced this the first week. I was near Lake Tahoe, right? And I was looking for a place to camp up in the mountains. And this guy asked me, hey, where are you coming from? And I was like, oh, I'm coming from, you know, from the coast. And he said, do you want to camp in my backyard? And I said, that's great. Like, thank you so much. And he was so kind to me. He cooked me dinner. I camped in his backyard. The next day he took me on a hike. He was being so kind. And then he just starts just rambling about just racist stuff, just racist things about Black people, right? And it was very confusing to me because in some ways I was like, man, this guy treated me so well and was so kind to me. But then he has this other aspect of him where he was very racist, right? And that was kind of another moment where I looked at my skin color and thought like, wow, like I wouldn't have been treated this way if I was Black, you know? So it was confusing at times because my personal experience with him was very great, but there's this other aspect to him.
Yeah, no, I had experiences like that in the U.S. Often, you know, I don't want to stereotype by regions, but it often happened in the South where there's sort of a culture of hospitality, but it was sort of coupled in with the same thing you pointed out, that if I had been a Black guy, you know, going through Alabama, then I might not have been welcomed in the same way. And so, but I think that's good to acknowledge, you know, that just because someone helps you doesn't mean that they're clean and pure of soul, you know, that people have different motivations for their hospitality. Yeah,
absolutely.
One thing I noticed that a lot of people had almost an instant familiarity or affinity. Some people confessed some things to you. Like there's a couple people who'd have loss in their lives and they felt like you were somebody they could talk to about that. Why do you think that came out of some of these interactions?
Great question. And again, I think it's because they saw somebody where was in a vulnerable position and they felt like they could relate. Because again, I think that's what, in some ways, grief and sadness really brings us together, right? And I think that they saw me and they thought maybe this person's going through a difficult time so I can express these things to them. And I also think that I really believe that we all feed off of each other's energy, right? And so the fact that I was in a vulnerable position, I think I was putting off a certain energy. They felt that and we connected in that way.
You often ask people, hey, when was the last time somebody showed a kindness to you or why did you help me? It almost feels like talking about kindness even asking someone to reflect on kindness makes them think about kindness. And it sort of creates this energy that sort of puts the idea of kindness in the world. Because it feels like that algorithm that is dictating our lives doesn't optimize kindness, right? You know, it looks for anxiety and fear and certain kinds of hatred. And so tell me about this ritual of sort of seeking kindness and asking about kindness as you went.
Yeah. So I think that when the question gets brought up, it throws someone into the moment, right? And then they realize how good they're feeling. And that was something that was so fascinating to see is, so for example, there was an unhoused man who was living on the streets, right? And he was the first person that helped me. And I originally declined to take his money because I felt like I can't do that because he's living on the streets. But he told me, he said, by you denying me the opportunity to do good, that I'm trying to do a kind act and you're denying me the opportunity to do good. And he said, I receive a lot from giving, right? So please don't deny me the opportunity to do good, right? And so I realized after talking to a lot of these people that they were gaining so much by helping somebody else, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. And it feels like sometimes, especially late in the documentary, when you were sort of exhausted, you just felt grateful for having been seen. When people helped you out, you felt seen and you sort of felt your humanity. And so I'm curious to know what sort of empathy came out of this experiment in just sort of having interactions with people on the margins that we don't usually interact with. Usually when we see a homeless person, we just hope they don't ask us for money as we're rushing on our way to our next appointment. Mm-hmm. What kind of empathy adventures did you have along the way as you took your physical adventure?
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely changed the way that I look at people who are struggling. And I'm not just talking people who are living on the street unhoused. I feel like doing that for 7 months, it showed me that there's so many opportunities that all of us have every single day to show up for someone in some way, right? And it's not just about giving food or money. It could be your coworker who you think, man, I can kind of feel like their energy is off. I'm just going to check in on them really quick. Right. And it's funny because for us, if we're the ones checking in, it may not seem like much at all. But for the person you're checking in on, it could literally change their life. I mean, when I was at my lowest point in Oregon, you know, I was sitting on the sidewalk. I didn't have my sign out, but I was feeling so mentally and physically beat up. Right. This was 6 months into the trip. Just the stresses of the lifestyle was really weighing me down. And people are walking past me on the sidewalk. And this man walks up to me and he says, hey, bro, you OK? I said, yeah, I'm just taking a little break. And he could feel my energy, right? And so he says, hang out here for a second. He runs across the street. He goes to a grocery store, buys me a bag of groceries with his food stamps. And I didn't even need groceries. I had food, right? But what I did need was I needed to be seen. And it's interesting because, and again, I think because this man was unhoused and he had faced a lot of hardships in his life, he felt the energy that I was putting out. And so he helped me. And then he shared a hug with me. Right. And that, and I'm bringing that story up because he was that guy who changed my life. And the beautiful thing about this is we can all be that person who shows up for someone in a moment like that. And it could literally change somebody's life.
Has it changed, at the risk of getting ahead, has it changed your way of seeing now that you're back home? Are you just more attuned, not just to people on the margins and unhoused people, but just like also people who might be needing to be seen for whatever reason, needing to be checked in a way that doesn't involve a smartphone screen?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I think I feel so grateful to have that now. I think that's something I hope never leaves, because I definitely find myself just checking in on people more often. And again, it's not about food or money. It's just letting them know. Just throwing it out there, just let you know, hey, if you ever need to talk or, you know, anything like that can mean so much to somebody. And it's the cool thing is with that, it doesn't take any money. Like we could all do that. That's something that could happen right now that the whole world can do, which is really beautiful.
And is it safe to say that you get a benefit from that as well?
Absolutely. If not more than them. I mean, because I do think that based on the people I was talking to, I do think that the majority of human beings want to do good. Right. And then again, another beautiful thing about going on this experience was their energy after when I would say thank you so much, and you could see how good they felt and how much they were receiving by giving. Right. Yeah.
Now, those are some of the most memorable parts of the documentary when people who don't have homes, for example, are looking out for you and making sure that you are okay.
Yeah.
There were several scenes that involved dumpster diving, like literally going to the garbage to find food. And actually, I know there's some people I know who just, even in this part of Kansas, who do it just because they don't like food waste or because it can save them money. But I don't think I've ever seen it in the way that I saw in your documentary. There's some really delicious looking strawberries in those dumpsters. There were entire packs of bananas. I mean, there was good stuff. So talk about like your approach to dumpster diving. It sounds like there's a book that you read about it. Just your experience with that aspect of the trip, because that sort of really surprised me when I watched the documentary.
Yeah, definitely. The book was by an environmental activist named Rob Greenfield. Right. And I read his book, and I knew that dumpster diving was going to be an option, but this was so much more food than I ever could have imagined being thrown away. And so on the coasts of the country, so the West Coast and the East Coast, there's like a larger unhoused population. So they lock the dumpsters, right, to keep people from taking the food, which when just that alone is thinking. So you're throwing away food in a dumpster, not in the compost bin, but in a dumpster, and you're locking it so people who are hungry can't get to it. It's just mind-boggling. But anyways, when I got to different parts of the country, there were grocery stores that didn't lock the dumpsters. And every morning, I mean, Aldi, Kroger, those are always my go-to spots. And actually, Aldi, I've done dumpster diving in Europe too, and Aldi's always the spot to go to if you're looking for good food. And but I had no idea so much food was being thrown away. And so every morning I would just go there and wait for them to throw away their food. Right. And I think it's because they get a new shipment of food in, and everybody's get afraid of getting sued in this country. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though the food would be good for weeks. Right. And so I would stock up on, you know, bananas, strawberries, apples, always tons of bread, pasta. There were steaks. I didn't grab the steaks, but there were steaks often, yogurt, ice cream, croissants, things like that. And I mean, I couldn't even stuff my bags full. And I mean, literally, there were dumpsters full. Like the whole dumpster. And it's crazy to me because it wasn't even getting composted, just getting thrown away in the dumpster.
Yeah, it's mind blowing. And I long ago, I worked at a grocery store stocking shelves. And I think I realized that to create the appearance of abundance, you know, a grocery store needs to look as if it has lots of food. You almost create the necessity for waste, you know, there's not enough people to buy that perfect amount of food every day. So it's so strange to think that there's all this, actually delicious and nutritious food sitting in dumpsters right now. And your documentary underscored that, I think. Any other things that were sort of surprising to you or things about the landscape or in the people you met that you absolutely didn't expect out of your journey when you started it?
Yeah. Let's see. Anything I didn't expect. Just the diverse amount of people that I saw across the country. That's what was just so beautiful to see, is like how different and from different backgrounds we all come. But at the same time, when people would share stories, I realized, like, I was riding through this area in West Virginia, and it was more like a, you know, there was a lot more poverty and crime, and riding my bike, and I saw these dudes throwing a football, you know? And so I was like, hey, I want to throw the football with these guys, right? And so they grew up with totally different backgrounds, right? And different experiences in life, all of that, different culture, et cetera. But the cool thing was, we connected. We connected by throwing the football around. And then we started sharing stories about like our childhood and our neighborhoods. And then I realized, oh, we're actually not that different. We're actually not that different. And that's what was revealing. And, you know, obviously more than anybody, like that's what travel does for you, right? There's that Mark Twain quote. It's like, what is it? Travel is prejudice to bigotry and narrow-mindedness.
Yeah, it's fatal. Like fatal to prejudice. Yeah, to bigotry and narrow-mindedness. Yeah, no, that was a fun scene in the movie because they're just kids. They're just teenagers who like playing sports. And I think sometimes, again, we can look down our noses at the brawny guys or whatever, but these are just kids who like playing, and they allowed you to play with them. And it feels like sports is one of many connectors worldwide that can just allow you to be a normal guy with somebody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And really quick, what was that quote again? Travel is fatal.
Yeah. Travel is fatal to prejudice. Prejudice and bigotry, I think.
Yes. Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah. Mark Twain.
Yeah. And I think that's from The Innocents Abroad, but it's a common quote because it's so appealing. And I think it's true in many ways that, you know, in some ways travel is fatal to bigotry and narrow-mindedness because it puts you into worlds not your own, you know, that suddenly you're with people who don't live in a house, you know, you're with people in a neighborhood where they're sort of teenagers like you might have grown up when you're young, but they're of a different race and they're from a different culture. And it's just, it's not like there's some ideal pie in the sky that travel does for you, but it just puts you in situations you're not used to. And it humanizes people across the board.
Humanizes, exactly. And gives you a better understanding of them, right?
Yeah. Are you in touch with anybody? Do you still have friends from coast to coast, or were they just people you met in passing?
Oh, it's really cool, man. Pretty much almost every single person I keep in contact with. There's a couple of the unhoused people I wasn't able to keep in contact with. But for example, the very last person who appears in the film, Tom, who was an unhoused person who was so kind, and he makes cartoons about helping the poor. I talk to him every Sunday, and it's so special to have these connections with these people.
I'm curious about the meta aspect. Like, you didn't just set off across America with this constraint and experiment, but you went with, it appears like, GoPros and drones and cameras. And so what was it like to document the experience, and how did that affect things as you went?
Yeah, so my number one concern was not letting people know in the moment that I was making a documentary, because it wouldn't be real. You know, they would act differently, et cetera. And I thought, how do I create a documentary without people knowing in the moment? And then I came up with the idea of getting camera glasses to wear. So when I was panhandling out there, people didn't know in the moment that I was actually recording the interactions that I had. And then afterwards, obviously, they'd sign a waiver, et cetera. But yeah, and then I had a GoPro on my chest to give you that first person view when I was biking, right? And then for the landscapes out in the mountains and the desert, I brought a drone, and I would program the drone with my phone to follow me, right? So it looks like somebody's filming me. And that was so much fun to be out in the mountains and break out the drone and give you this really like epic, like, you know, landscape footage. And as far as charging the stuff, I would stop in libraries every couple of days, and I would charge my stuff there and also unload my footage onto a hard drive.
How much footage did you accumulate? Because if you traveled for such a long time, you must have been hours and hours and hours that were shrunk down to less than 2 hours.
Yeah, that's what was so difficult about making this film, is because I had hundreds of interactions, right? And there was hundreds of hours of conversations. And I wanted to limit it so it keep a message and a theme with the movie, right? And so there was a lot of beautiful things that happened that didn't make the film. This was hard to cut out just because it didn't, you know, kind of continue with the message of the movie. But definitely the editing process was so tough, especially also with the drone footage. There was so much drone footage that I had, and it was kind of heartbreaking not to be able to use it in the film, but I needed to keep the story rolling, you know?
What were some of the interesting things that were left on the cutting room floor? What are some stories or people or landscapes that didn't quite make it in?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most influential thing that happened to me the whole journey was it happened in East St. Louis. I was riding through East St. Louis, which, as you know, has a really high crime rate, and usually it's one or two in America, right? The highest. And as I was coming out of East St. Louis, this guy yells at me from across the street, and he's like, "Hey, man," he's like, "what are you doing in this neighborhood?" His name was Harold, right? And he came up to me and he started talking to me, right? And within a couple minutes, he just started sharing his story with me, right? And he had just got out of prison. He was only 24 years old. Hmm. He'd served 6 years in prison. His clothes were in tatters, right? And then after only a couple of minutes, he starts sobbing on my shoulder, crying, right? And talking about how he's terrified to go to sleep at night because he sleeps under a bridge in East St. Louis. And then he lifts up his shirt, and he had a scar from his chest down to below his stomach when somebody in prison carved him open, right? So he was so traumatized, and I'll never forget this. He said, he's 24, and he said, "I don't know how much longer I'm going to be around for," right? And for me, hearing that, I thought about my life, and when I was 24, I was backpacking around Europe. I was in college. My life was just starting to open up. And this person, because he was just born into these really unfortunate circumstances, he was born into poverty in East St. Louis, in lack of opportunity, in gangs, and drugs, and crime. And the sad thing is he probably didn't make it, you know, and that was so incredibly impactful for me. And I'm so grateful for meeting him. And, that was another life-changing moment for me. And then just the filmmaker aspect. I mean, there is that part of me that would have loved to have been able to capture that, but I just didn't, I was in the moment and I didn't want to break up my camera and interrupt this real life moment with this person, you know? So
you didn't film that one. It didn't get in because there's no footage of it.
There's no footage of it. And I was also, it was, as I rode through East St. Louis, I didn't break out my camera equipment because I felt like that was, could kind of put me in danger. There was a lot of crime and just, and there was also a sort of like respect aspect too. I felt like I didn't want to be going through these neighborhoods and like filming their unfortunate circumstances for like a documentary, if that makes sense.
Years ago, I lived in Korea, and I took pictures all over the place, but people were most nervous about it in the poor parts of Korea. I think that poor people feel a self-consciousness of being sort of objectified in their situation.
That's a great word to use, objectified. And you've probably seen those YouTube videos lately of like people going like in quotes, like, oh, I'm going into the hood. And it's just like these people, like entitled people who are filming to get YouTube views. They're filming people's unfortunate circumstances so they can gain like a following on YouTube. It's really sickening, honestly.
Well, that sounds like that's part of the problem that you're trying to explore here, you know, that people are physically going to a place, but in an extractive way, you know, they're not
exactly.
Really. Yeah. Is East St. Louis where you had a woman worried for your safety?
Yeah. She pulled over and she told me like, are you lost? And she said, you shouldn't be in this neighborhood. And she said, you can put your bike in my car. I'll take you where you're going, et cetera. And, she was very concerned for my safety. And I mean, I appreciated that, but also I chose to ride through there because I thought it was important to ride through all parts of America to give me a perspective, not just like the safe, beautiful areas.
Yeah, that is something that all travelers can do. I mean, obviously there's safety concerns anywhere, but often it doesn't occur to us to walk into a poor neighborhood and look for a restaurant or something, you know, that, you know, people everywhere have to eat somehow. And so within reason, it does make sense to literally stretch your comfort zone in that sense, I would suppose.
That's absolutely, Rolf. And again, kind of going back to that story, I would have met Harold, that person who shared that story with me, if I didn't go through East St. Louis, and that changed my life. So there are, obviously you got to be aware and try to be safe, but I think that there are some really great opportunities that can come from really stepping out of your comfort zone and going to places where you normally wouldn't go.
What's your experience in filmmaking? Is this your first film, or have you done it before, or what's...
Yeah. That's the funny thing is, I mean, I made one film that's on YouTube called Two Wheels to Freedom. It was about riding my bike across Europe. And, but this was my first feature. And the beautiful thing, I love sharing this with people, is I didn't go to film school. I didn't really know what I was doing when I left. I didn't know how to set up a shot. I was learning how to use the drone on the go. And the thing I want to share is sometimes I think that we all have ideas in life. And then sometimes there's that voice inside our head that says, oh, like, no, that won't work, or you won't be any good at that. But what I want to share is I think if you have some idea, just go, even if you're not qualified for it, or if you think it won't be good, just go and just go for it. And because you never know what can happen out of it.
And you're at work right now. What's work for you?
Yeah. So I work in a physical therapy clinic. I'm a trainer in a physical therapy clinic.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It sounds like your first bike trip, you just did it without ever having camped before. And this time you did it without ever having made a feature film before. You just decided to do it and see what happened.
Absolutely. And I think a big part of it, Rolf, is I think that we have these intuition, these gut feelings. And I think when you have those, listen to those feelings, because those speak truer than any other feeling, I think.
Did you study film technique or anything before you went? Because I noticed there's some nice establishing drone shots. There's also some ground shots where it's clear that you had a tripod on a curve in the road, and then you set it up and you drove down the curve and you went back and got your camera. So, how did your technique evolve as the journey went over as a filmmaker in addition to bicycler?
Yeah. So the GoPro, I wouldn't say that evolved very much, honestly, as I went, you know. But the drone footage, definitely, especially when I was in these, you know, some days there wouldn't be much going on. I'm riding through, just maybe the plains, or like in a desert or something where there's not, the landscape isn't changing too much. And there was a vast landscape. So I would break up my drone and just kind of play around with it. Right. And think, oh, what if I were to do a shot where it's circling me? Let's see what that would look like, or like a fadeaway shot. And I was just playing around with it. And as time went on, I started to notice, okay, these shots are the go-to ones for this particular area. Like when I was in the mountains, I was going up this 11,000 foot mountain pass in Montana, and there was a storm coming. And I knew with that shot, okay, you need to show this whole mountain pass. So let's do a fadeaway shot. But I was just learning on the fly, honestly.
Were there any moments where you could turn left or turn right, and you think, I'm going to turn right because there's a better story there? I mean, I ask this as a travel writer, who sometimes it just feels necessary to sort of push my comfort zone in the interest of a story. So how did How did that come into play in this journey?
That is so amazing that you said that, because I do the same thing when I travel. I did it this past summer also. I hitchhiked across Europe when I could have taken a train. But going back to what you were saying as far as this documentary, actually hitchhiking. Yeah, I got to New York City and there was a feeling like I didn't get what I thought I was going to get out of this experience, right? And so I thought, well, I need to switch things up. So I decided to hitchhike, right? And hitchhiking got me a lot farther quicker. And it just changed a lot, because with hitchhiking, you really got to trust your gut feeling. And that's a great question. And hitchhiking did it for me for sure. And I mean, there's no question. I mean, being in Montana, I could have gone south too. I wanted to be in the north part of the country because I wanted to kind of experience the elements it was October and it was always already 13 degrees in Montana, but I wanted to do that because it was going to make it more interesting as far as a travel experience goes. Definitely. I mean, I could have gone south and the weather would have been much more mild, but you know how it is when you're traveling. Sometimes you want to push yourself out of your comfort zone because that's when you learn the most about yourself. And yeah.
How many months total was the journey coast to coast and back?
Yeah. So it was seven. So I left in May and then I got back right before Christmas in December. And those last 2 months, I mean, if I wasn't making a documentary, there's no way I would have finished those last 2 months because my body was just mangled there was 3 nights specifically sleeping in 13 degree weather. And I didn't have winter gear with me because I wasn't planning on being on the road for that long. So I only had summer gear. So those 3 nights I was wearing every piece of clothing that I had in my tent, and I was afraid I was gonna get hypothermia. And the interesting thing was after those 3 nights, it sucked the strength out of me. And so for the next 6 weeks biking back to California, I was doing maybe 30 miles a day and I was exhausted every day. And my body was definitely staying stopped.
I noticed it felt like you got hassled more by like supermarket security and stuff in that last little stretch. Does it feel like sort of your energy had changed? And why do you reckon that happened at the very end of the trip?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's for sure it was my appearance. My beard grew long and scraggly. And then, yeah, like you said, the energy I was putting out there, I was pushing people away with my energy because I was feeling weighed down from the lifestyle. I mean, specifically when I was in Paterson, New Jersey, there was one night, 3 a.m, I was in a gang neighborhood. I was sleeping behind a warehouse and someone came up to my tent and I literally thought I was going to die. Like, and so after that moment, like, I was traumatized the rest of the way. And so like whenever nighttime came, I was really paranoid. And just even as the sun was starting to go down, I started to feel a level of anxiety for the last couple months. And again, like those stresses of being out in public all the time, trying to find a place to bathe, that energy was being pushed out there. And it's interesting because that was when I needed the help the most but I was pushing people away the most.
How did the journey differ, if at all, from the film itself? Because obviously any form of storytelling is reductive, but when you take 7 months and you put it down to less than 2 hours, you sort of have to make editing decisions in the interest of story and message and theme like that. So what are some things that are inside your memory that aren't quite in the film, and how did the tone and the experience differ?
Yeah, I love that question. No one's ever asked that question. I'm so glad you asked it because, you know, the first couple of times I watched the film when it was in film festivals, when it first came out, I felt so underwhelmed because I thought there's no way that I could capture these feelings of 7 months and having all these interactions with these people. And now I try to separate the two. I just look at it. Okay, this is the film that came out of the experience, right? But I feel like it doesn't really come close to the actual experience. As far as some of those moments, I mean, there'd be numerous times where I would tear up just having conversations, listening to these people and truly feeling their kindness, right? And then just the physical aspect of it, like that lifestyle, like on the go for 7 months, as you know, when you're traveling, it can be so exhausting just sleeping in different places, right? And I don't think the film captures like the physical aspect of how difficult it was. And then I was embarrassed too, man. I mean, I was embarrassed by showing mental weakness. I mean, there's one part of the film where I cry on camera, but I mean, that happened a lot of times and I felt very insecure about putting that into the film because in some ways I felt like, okay, so I'm choosing to go and put myself in this vulnerable position and now I'm crying about it. Like there was an insecurity about that, but I feel like that's some of the most real moments of the trip were those moments.
When you came home, what was the take home? Like 7 months on the road, all kinds of experiences, including filming yourself and meeting people who you probably wouldn't have met at home. You definitely would have met at home. So what was the take home?
Yeah. So it took me honestly probably a year to fully process what just the whole experience. But I think more than anything is that quote that comes to mind, you know, it's that there's more that brings us together than what separates us. That's probably the biggest thing. And again, it's just talking to these people and not jumping straight into politics, you know, talking to them, getting to know them about their life and their experiences, right? And then easing into things, and then you have a better understanding of them, and then you have less fear about them, right? And then the other thing that comes to mind is just every day, like, we can be that person who shows up for somebody else, you know? And right now, especially in the world, there's so many things that are crazy and can feel like overwhelming and out of our control. But like the people that I met when I was out there, they showed me that the one thing that we can control is how we treat each other, right? And that doesn't cost any money. We could all do that right now.
Would you or will you do this again? Or what's next in your project? It sounds like you hitched across Europe. What kind of journeys or adventures do you have in store, or have you retired?
Yeah. No, definitely. You know how it is with the travel bug. It's just each time you travel and you're kind of, I'm sure you can relate to this, Rolf. Like every time I travel, I'm trying to capture that culture shock from, you know, when you first started traveling. And so what I've been doing, which I think you can relate to, is I'm trying to find different ways to recapture that culture shock and that magic from travel. So what I want to do next is I want to bike across South America. That's definitely what I want to do. And I love speaking Spanish, and I think it'd be great to connect with people from a different culture that way. As far as I will bring money this time, I would not do it again without food or money, because that lifestyle, I think that it took a toll on me for sure. And it took some physical and mental recovery after that. And I don't think I would ever do that aspect again.
You will bring money to South America. Will you bring camera equipment and a GoPro and a drone?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely going to make another documentary about it for sure. I definitely want to just ride through, you know, the Andes and see Peru and Chile and all of that, and just meet the people. I mean, learn about their cultures for sure.
Well, it sounds like your USA documentary has been to some film fests and stuff. What has been the life of the documentary, and where can people find it?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So it's been super special playing in these film festivals, because I feel like whenever it gets recognition or wins an award, it's a collaboration with all the people that I met, which is really cool. So it's like, if it wins an award, it's like, we did this together, you know, and that's the theme of the movie, is togetherness, right? And so the film, which is called We Are All In This Together, it's available on Apple TV, Google Play, and Amazon Prime, right? And that's where you can find the movie. And if you're interested in reading more about the movie, you can go to weareallinthistogethermovie.com.
Awesome. Any final thoughts about, you know, a lot of people in my audience are travelers and might be thinking, huh, should I do this? Or might be just thinking, how should I ride my bike across my own hometown? Like, what final thoughts do you have in the wake of this project?
Yeah, well, the really cool thing is, if you are interested in going on some kind of bike tour, there's no rules. Like, you don't have to ride all the way across the country. You can do, like you just said, you can do 5 miles a day, right? And you can take a weekend and you can do a small little bike tour across your town, right? And it doesn't have to be this like extreme adventure to have to be like very meaningful, right? And I think that with travel, the other thing that comes to mind, Rolf, is just, you know, we only have this small time frame of where we're physically capable of doing these kind of traveling, right? And a lot of us say, well, I'll do that when I'm retired. Well, who's to say, first of all, you will retire, right? And who's to say that you're going to be physically capable of doing that, or you'll even want to do that? I think that when you're physically capable, go for it and have these like unique experiences, right? Because you not only learn about yourself, you learn about the world. And yeah, working in physical therapy, you know, I see that our bodies aren't going to be capable forever, right? And so while you can, go ahead and push it and learn about yourself and learn about the world.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including how to watch Daniel Troya's film We Are All In This Together, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.
A real quick side note, Rolf, like Kansas, by far, was the most genuine, kind people I've ever met in my whole life.
Wow.
By far. A lot of times people are like, where was the nicest people? Kansas, for sure. I'll remember, you know, I was telling a story about my judgments. There was this guy who pulled over when I was panhandling, and he had like all camo gear, right? Big beard. And again, big truck. And so I was judging him, right? And he says, I see that you needed some help. And he said, did that guy just give you some food? Some guy gave me food. And I said, yeah. And the guy in the truck starts tearing up, and he says, that makes my heart warm to see that somebody helped you. And it was like, it was so like beautiful to see. And again, it revealed my own judgments about people. Right.
I'm so happy to hear this. And I might put this after the outro, just like a little Easter egg about Kansas at the very end.